an Ironic Media production. Visit us at ironicmedia.com.
And then there are professionals like you and the placement people that they're trying to do their job. They have great plans for the family, and now they want to coordinate services, and the family are disagreeing. One wants them to be placed. One wants them to stay home. One wants them to pay for 24-hour care. One of them wants to be independent. One of them is power of attorney and they don't trust them, and all these kinds of things that come in. So many, many times the attorney says, whoa, this isn't legal stuff. This is like family stuff. And they're frustrated because you can't get going. So they get stuck.
Hello, and welcome to Dementia Discussions, the podcast for and about caregivers. If you'd like to share your caregiving story with me, I'd love to hear from you. Please call me and leave a message at 310-362-8232 or send me an email at dementiadiscussions.net. Today, my guest is Bunny Dibness. Bunny is a friend and colleague for many years. Bunny is a licensed marriage family therapist. She has been an aging life care manager for years, and now she is a family mediator, and she'll tell you more about that soon. Bunny, great to have you here. Thanks so much for coming on.
Barbara, it's a thrill to see you and to be involved in your program. Thank you for having me.
Tell everyone how it is you came to geriatrics.
It's an interesting story, and I thank you for asking, and please forgive me if it gets a little long, because it really was a journey. So first off, I was born, raised, educated, and raised my family in West Los Angeles. And after attending UCLA, as many in my generation did, I became a school teacher and stayed on an extra year for graduate education in elementary education. And as soon as I got into this career and started teaching after a couple of years, I really realized my personality and structure and routine just were not compatible. Love the kids and love the psychodynamics of it, but I was frankly bored. So that starts my career journey in what turned out to be crazily geriatric. So I took a UCLA extension class on death and suicide by a renowned professor of thanatology at the time, Dr. Edwin Steidman. And he was a teacher at the medical school over at UCLA to teach residents and interns and whatnot how to deal with dying with terminally ill clients and the bereavement involved with their families. So 8 of us were chosen for a fellowship on death and dying. I had no previous training, but really, really was fascinated by the dying process and the adjustment it made and how most people are normal and they go through a process. And if they have the support they need, they can go through this process in a way that's really consistent with the way they are. The other part of this I learned, and this brings me to today, is that dying was a family affair, and it not only impacted the person that was dying, but the whole family unit. And I took that with me, and it made so much sense. I was then hired as, actually, I went on to school and was interested in families and the family systems and adjustment reactions and all that. So I went on to Cal State Northridge, got my master's degree in ed psych marriage family therapy, and was hired at Brotman Memorial Center at that time as the first thanatologist actually in the city. And my job was to support the staff and families and dying people in the hospital that were facing life-threatening illness. And after about 3 months of doing 40 hours a week of therapy, I went back to my routine of it and realized I'm better served here. And I started what was called the Life Transition Program and went on to develop a program for paraprofessionals, professionals, interns to work with the terminally ill, give psychological support to the terminally ill and bereavement issues. So that's what I did for several years. I became a consultant when the new field of hospice was coming on and did consulting and training and speaking and those kinds of things. And that was the lesson I learned, that working with end of life is again, and adjustments, what brought me closer to where I am in geriatrics. My next job was at Century City Hospital, where interesting you worked as well, but I was in diabetes outpatient. There was a new diabetes outpatient center being developed, and they asked me to man the psychosocial part. And once again, I knew nothing about diabetes, but I knew about adjustment reactions and supervision and coping and loss. So I did that. After that, I now had three young children and one with special needs. And I spent some time doing groups for parents of special needs kids, parents of handicapped kids, and actually parents with disabilities that had normal kids. Again, it was a similar theme. It seems so different, but it had to do with adjusting and loss and acceptance. So that brought me to now looking for a new career. And I was hired at Jewish Family Service in Los Angeles at the Freedom Moore Center, actually to supervise what they had called as case aid. There was a paraprofessional support staff for the multi-purpose senior center. At that time, because of funding, they said, well, while you're doing that, you're going to be supervising a city-run case management program. So I knew how to supervise, but I didn't know what case management was. I'd never heard of it. I'd been in a different field. I was into family systems and death and dying, but not aging. So they told me what case management was. And my response is, what a great idea. So I loved it. I didn't know anything about case management. The good thing for me is Jewish Family Service had wonderful, capable social workers that did know what case management was. So I honed my skills on that. And when the opportunity arose to run their fee-for-service private case management for people with the financial resources to pay and more complicated families, I quickly took on the challenge. And I really embraced it. Now I could deal with the families and the complicated issues. And again, the issues of aging that were going on. Once again, it really supported my idea that not only was dying a family affair, but aging was a family affair. So I stayed at JSF for many years, thought I was going to retire. And then in 1999, I got the opportunity. I was invited to join then what was called Live Home, a venture capital company that was really positioned to raise the bar in elder care by using the best care management as its foundation in home care. So I was brought on as the first director of their first office. As the company grew, I was made director of professional services. And that's where I was able to pick and choose what I wanted to do. So my job there was supporting the staff when there were complicated cases, getting involved in our National Association of Geriatric Care Managers and taking leadership positions there, and being involved in the community on numerous boards in the community, on numerous leadership positions in my professional association, so I could really understand the dynamics of aging and family and the complications involved in there. As I stayed at Live Home, I also started doing expert legal testimony for assessments and expert witness for cases that had to go to court. Attorneys would hire me for conservatorships to be the expert. And I ended up accidentally again getting into mediation. And this is where I started this, because there was a group of individuals that were interested in serving the needs of older adults in the community, both the private, nonprofit, attorneys, judges, those that were interested in mediation and Aldo aging. Because part of my expert witness work involved doing assessments for mediation as a professional, not as a mediator. I didn't really quite know what mediation was, but I was hired to be the expert on these cases. So they had information regarding the older adult. They asked me to be on their board. And at that time, I'm going, I don't really understand this mediation. I do family meetings, and I don't know why you need a mediator, because when I get stuck, I just send them to the legal system, to courts, to lawyers, to conservators and that. And once I saw mediation in action, I really said, boy, some of those clients that I just get stuck. I mean, I know family systems, I know good communication, but sometimes it's much more complicated than that. So
what a, you've had such an interesting
path. So that's how I am where I am. And as I retired from Live Home and went out on my own, I looked at what do I really want to do? And this conflict resolution that breaks up families, that costs the fortune, that breaks parents' heart. I looked at the different continuum, and certainly mediation is one of those tools that can work beautifully with this people. So there, I'm sorry for the long-winded.
That's okay. Fascinating.
There I am at mediation.
There you are. And so you said something really interesting about breaking parents' hearts, which that's so true. Let's talk about that a little bit, about being a mediator and what you do as a mediator. And have you had training? Is there courses, certifications? How does that work?
Like all the other fields I was interested in, once I decided this was of interest to me, and not just as an expert witness, or although I do that on very complicated cases that are beyond my scope, I started looking for mediation that was compatible with me. So I called an elder mediator up in Sausalito, Dana Curtis, and asked her how she recommended what would be the best mediation course for me. So I was up, I took a 40-hour course in basic training in mediation up in Northern California. Then Strauss Institute at Pepperdine Law School had an elder mediation course. So I took that, and I've taken several other specialty courses in various aspects of mediation. The last one being during the pandemic, I took a 20-hour advanced training. So that's my training in mediation.
And who do you see? Is it mostly, like you were saying, complicated family cases? Is it children calling you?
Yeah.
They're not getting along with their sibling? Like, who's calling you?
You know, I basically get the calls come in when families are stuck. The three main categories are children that are in conflict. They have different opinions on what their aging parent needs or wants. They have unresolved issues that mom always liked you better, and favoritism. There's caregiver burdens. There's cases, you know, I think I've heard them all, and then I hear a new one, and we can talk a little bit about that later, the kind of cases I take. The second most common are when there are adult children, and many times they're all in agreement, and there's a second spouse. And the second spouse often has been married for many, many years to their parent, but it's not their biological parent, and they didn't raise them. So many don't consider them, some do, but most don't consider them a step parent. They consider them their father's wife or their mother's husband. And the third I get are when there's resistant older adults and adult children, or the spouse absolutely doesn't know what to do. And we can talk about the goals and reasons and those kind of things later on, if you want to, in terms of kind of what my goals are and how I'm a little bit different from a regular elder mediator, to clarify what I call aging life mediation as opposed to elder mediation, because I sort of made it up as a hybrid kind of mediation. So,
Okay, so it sounds like kind of quarreling siblings is one category of folks that are calling you. And maybe there's an attorney in the picture, but these are like issues that are not exactly legal, more like family.
About half of my cases do come from attorneys.
Mm, okay.
They can't do their work. Interesting enough. And then there are professionals like you and the placement people that they're trying to do their job. They have great plans for the family. And now they want to coordinate services, and the family are disagreeing. One wants them to be placed. One wants them to stay home. One wants them to pay for 24-hour care. One of them wants to be independent. One of them is power of attorney and they don't trust them, and all these kinds of things that come in. So many, many times the attorney says, whoa, this isn't legal stuff. This is like family stuff. And they're frustrated because you can't get going. And that, so they get stuck. So, and the other ones are with, and I've done a few of late with these second marriages. It turns out blood is thicker than water. And when push comes to shove and there's money involved and caregiving involved, you can imagine. And many of these come from the second spouse that are really devoted to their either spouse or long-term partner. And in these days, for various reasons, there's partners of 25, 30 years, and they're brokenhearted because they're formerly stepchildren that always got along are now feuding and pressuring them and all these other kinds of things. So
these are such common situations, what you're talking about. We see this so often, right? So yeah, either siblings who are not on the same page. So you're trying to get them to talk about these conflict resolution, get on the same page with the goals for mom or dad. Mm-hmm. And then step-parents who have been married to their dad for could be 20, 30 years. So a long time, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You see them, Barbara, and they're devoted and
yeah,
they have another spouse. But, you know, I mean that their parents have a biological mother maybe that they're loyal to, or it has to do with finances or isolation. There's extreme cases. We know of Casey Kasem case and mm-hmm. lovely CEO cases that were a disaster and really tore the families apart. So yeah. And the other ones I get all the time are the parents are resistant to any care. They don't have capacity perhaps, and they're a danger to themselves, and the families disagree on what to do, how heavy-handed they should be, or if they should let them wait for a crisis or all these kinds of things. So it seems like they're always women in their 90s that are as independent as anything. They're pretty healthy, but they're stubborn as anything. And the first thing I say on the phone is, your mother is not going to change because I have that magic pill and I'm going to change a 90-year-old. But we can work around that.
That's typical in my world too.
I just want one caveat before, because as I mentioned, mediation is one tool that I use. Mm-hmm. But before mediation, that's a structured process that, as I mentioned, is a hybrid of my background. But sometimes it's talking one-on-one to a person and just giving them information, and a one-time consultation is enough to know that these are the realities of the situation and know they can't put their mother in a fancy assisted living on Medi-Cal or this kind of stuff. And the other are family meetings for families that basically get along and they all want their mom to be safe and they know there's a problem. They're willing to work together. They just don't have the communication skills. With so much of what we do, I think it's communication. And if they can have a facilitator just communicating what they say and a few guidelines, they don't even need the formal mediation process. A lot of these siblings, quite honestly, can't stand each other. They never really got along, or oftentimes they just had nothing to do with each other. They lived 3,000 miles away. There were issues, but they let them go. And all of a sudden they have to deal with each other for the first time. And they found out they really have issues. And those are the ones that mediation is perfect for. I always like to say, if you love your mother more than you hate your siblings, I can help you with mediation. Because I always used to say that all the time and people smile, but there are people that hate their siblings, like in divorces, more than they love their parents. And that's when the legal field, and we can talk about that later, that it really becomes beyond the scope of mediation because all they want to do is screw their sibling.
Right, right.
So it's a difference. So I think that if you can remember one thing, if the goal is really to take care of the parent and not break their heart and have all this fighting and being that's what this whole process is remembered by is the kids fighting. We have a mutual friend that will remain nameless that has four daughters. And when he thought he was dying of COVID, his last words from closed in his bedroom is, please get along.
Right.
That for many parents is all they want. And that's why I get so many calls from the older parent themselves. They just want their kids to get along mm-hmm. and they don't want them to be in court afterwards. And they want the cousins to be able to speak and all those kinds of things. So
it's really true. And I've said this before, my mother, when she was alive and she died tragically, suddenly in a car accident. But before that, she would always say, I just want you kids to get along. And that's what we all remembered. So I guess that's what you're saying to families. Look, we have to put the family history, like your sibling history aside, and let's just focus on the goal for your parent.
I do as a lot of what I do, it's because I'm so goal oriented and I have a few goals that we can talk about. I always identify there are people in every almost every group when there's enough siblings that really needs individual therapy. And I will refer out to individual therapy to deal with their own issues. But this is not the goal at hand. The goal at hand is to not make things worse and on a number of profiles. So that's really the goal of this stuff. And I keep reminding them my structure of mediation, keep reminding them of the goals and not going there that mom. And it's true, this older generation, they oftentimes favored the men. And I had a couple cases where the men were literally felons and the daughter, one had a PhD and one was an MD. And the brothers were the power of attorney for finances because they were the males. So
yeah, I had one daughter say to me, my brother's an only child.
Yeah. That's true. And those are things you have to work out in therapy, not in a process where the goal is to not break the parents' heart and let's keep it and maintain, not make it worse. Whether some of these cases I take are already in conservatorship. So there's already a legal aspect of it, but don't make it more complicated and cost you tens of thousands of dollars in court suing each other to who's right legally. These contested conservatorships are fraught with this kind of stuff. So it's reducing the friction. So that's what the goals are. These are.
And to try to come up just with a simple plan for, okay, let's say it's keeping mom at home with care.
Right.
Right. Like we're just talking about her safety, how we're going to get there. Do you want her to stay home, or do you want her to move?
I mean, when I started doing this and getting these calls, I go, oh my God, how am I ever going to get them to agree on anything? Their opinions, their positions are 180 degrees opposed. But it's amazing. I mean, this process, it really works. And for most people, there are some exceptions, but it really can work. So the truth is for many, many of the families that call me and use my services, they do it to save money. They don't want to spend the money on attorneys. They already see what it costs. They choose not to use a more formalized mediation where I won't use attorneys. I work with attorneys a lot for information as experts on trusts and elder law and elder care and elder abuse. But when they are in the sessions, they can't be represented by an attorney. I don't share counsel. And I do that by design because when an attorney is there, he's representing an individual. And that means there's a right and a wrong and a winning and losing. And that's not the point of mediation. But they do really call me. I know for very practical reasons, I'm less expensive than an attorney and they don't have experts on the side. And if they go to court and they're spending tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars to pursue court and they're stuck, as I said, stuck and the normal doesn't work.
And what you're saying is exactly true. So if there's attorneys involved, you're not speaking to each other. You're speaking through your attorney, right?
And I've been in mediations before. I've been expert witnesses in mediations. I was in one and this is something that's beyond my scope. It was run by a retired judge. There were 9 attorneys in the room, all well-known in different fields. And it was a simple case, but it dealt with a lot of money and it's expensive. I'm thinking, boy, this day is costing them tens of thousands of dollars for this simple kind of thing that, you know, and ultimately the mediator listened to me, which was great. And I got flowers from the wife.
Right.
People can complicate things. And sometimes, as I said, you really do need an attorney and you need those judges and people with specific expertise that I don't have.
Where sometimes just getting siblings on a Zoom or getting a mother and daughter in a room or on a Zoom, so much can be accomplished. It's unbelievable. Where a child feels like they've been shut out from decisions, from the money for so long. And then you get people in the room together and it's amazing. The breakthroughs that can happen.
Yeah. Look, you have the skills and the clinical skills and a lot of professionals have the background to facilitate communication. And as long as that works, you don't go any further. It's a continuum. It's when they get stuck. It's not logical. There's something underlying it. And whether it's to get more money or
more control,
sibling or more control or mm-hmm. or really want to get back at their parents because they were terrible parents in the first place, or they don't, all the other kinds of reasons that don't make sense. That's when I get involved, when they're stuck. So there are rules. There are rules of decorum for mediation. And that's one of the advantages. Right off, I'm doing one next week. I'm actually in the process of talking to the families now. This is with a second wife. And the daughter said, if she's going to yell at me and say scathing things, I don't want to be on the phone. Part of the process to remind people and stop it when it starts. So the things when people are doing it themselves and these, you know, crazy emails they send and threats and accusations and all these kinds of things, that's what you got to stop. And I'm sure there's some mental illness in this particular case.
To put out ground rules.
Before I send them out and then I have them read them out loud. And I remind them very clearly of the ground rules. Yeah, there is a process of mediation that goes on and gives everybody equal footing on the floor. One of the things that happens in families is, especially, and it seems like everybody has 3 to 5 siblings in these things, there's always a dominant one that, and the others are intimidated and just back off. And when they give a chance, and many times they're the power of attorney, that other people don't know what's going on with the money. All they have to do is let them know. It's let them see the bank statements. You're doing the right thing and nobody's stealing from anybody, but they don't know. There's fear involved. It's that, as you said, it's getting the mother and the daughter on the same thing. So there's communication. It's hearing the mother say, I know I'm at risk of falling, but I can't move to a facility. It'll kill me faster than any fall will happen, this kind of thing, and understanding what are the values of the older adult. And this is this ongoing, and I think as a social worker and everything we've been trained, is the balance of safety and autonomy. So if you have one very cautious sibling and one very, very risk-taking siblings, and they're looking at mom, and everybody forgets to look at mom and see what she wants and what she would have done 20 years from now. Some of these 90-year-olds or 95-year-olds, you have to take a deep breath sometime, but it is their right to risk to folly. That's different than not having capacity.
Absolutely. Yeah. And people do have the right to make wrong decisions.
Well, if they have the capacity to do so. And that's
exactly
where the deal breaker when I get these kids. See, my mom doesn't want any 24-hour care.
Right. But mom has cognitive impairment. Right. Yeah. And is at risk. Yes.
Let's look at these medications that they're all over the floor in the refrigerator. She says she's eating 3 meals and there's one tomato in there, this kind of stuff. And that's where, of course, people like you and why I so believe and spent 20 years of my professional career on care management, because I think a lot of this resolves issues just by doing your assessments and your care plans as a professional. And then it makes some objectivity of this. And a lot of this can be resolved very, very quickly. And that's why these in 3 hours oftentimes is all it takes to take care of these things.
Really? So you can meet with a family for a few hours. It doesn't have to be like a weekly anything.
No, I've never done a mediation that's more than 7 hours.
Wow. So
I block off typically 3 hours to do it. I talk to each of the parties beforehand privately. It's confidential discussions, but I know how far they're going to go. And I let them know if they want this information out there, they're going to have to speak up because I'm not going to do it. And I always follow up with a written plan because people can say anything. Many times, if they involve real estate and trust and estate or all this, they have to go to attorneys for a next step. But it's much different having an attorney write up a piece of paper, a document or a promissory note than having two sides fighting it out and going to court and having a judge decide. So, yeah.
So you talk to the siblings first. So all the siblings
first,
and then schedule a meeting. And is it with the parent, with the senior?
It depends. There oftentimes are called by the parent. So obviously there are other times when the parent really doesn't have capacity, so they're not involved in the system. Sometimes in addition to the children, I will talk to the professionals. I'll either read the reports that the professionals made, especially on capacity and these kind of things, geriatric care management reports. I have one came in, actually the caller yesterday came, that was given to me by a care manager that said, I never turn down difficult cases. They intrigue me, but I can't be with your father. But there are all kinds of reports. I have the report from the care manager, so we save time. I report from the neuropsychologist on capacity issues, in this case of the mother. I have those, so I review those reports before, so at least I have a context. I ask the permission if they can be in the mediation. No, I know mom doesn't think she needs care, but she's severely demented and she doesn't have capacity to make that decision. You know, I won't break confidentiality unless they let me. So I have the buy-in to use that. It's admissible. If they say, no, this is private, I got it done, my brother doesn't know, then I can't bring it up unless they do.
I see.
It really depends on the situation. And as I do it, I'm pretty flexible in terms, but I know what I need. And the more information I have, the better, and the more understanding of the dynamics. And I can tell, you know, it's I've been a therapist for longer than I've been anything, when there's really emotional issues with one of the siblings. And I'll encourage them. Many of them already have therapists, but I'll really encourage them to get into therapy to deal with these unresolved issues that they've had.
Right. That's oftentimes what's the obstacle to getting.
Or they feel like they're not understood, or the brother's taking control and all these kind of things. And then maybe the brother really is more competent. There's all kinds of things that come up. And what I find, though, the truth is, because I'm very clear, my goals are to protect the older adult if they're still alive, to maintain the integrity of the family, and to avoid costly legal battles, protracted legal battles. I stay within that. So when I ask the families, and this is part of the process, what their issues are, and I list them up and what they want, not the position they should be living here, but I want my mom safe. I want her to have three meals. I want to be able to visit. I want my children to be able to see her. I want to have Friday night dinners with my father. I put those all up on a board of everybody, and I can scratch out the common ones. I find that 80% of the goals, and this is consistent because I looked at them, are similar. So I only deal with the ones they're fighting about. And that usually is a very narrow, probably 1 in 5 of the issues that they're, we all want mom safe. We all want her to have peace of mind. Nobody wants to be fighting. Those are all given. So let's cross those out. Let's look at the ones that we disagree on. I think mom's better, more social, and you think she's an introvert, this kind of thing, whatever it is that's different. And that's the only thing we mediate. I don't go over, hey, I could spend days going over everything that we already know that stuff. We don't have to argue that stuff. And I think it makes people feel better that for many of these, as I said, they have to love they have to care about their parent. They feel better. They know we're all looking at this, and then we deal with the areas of difference. And there are inequities in that.
And there's some compromise, I'm sure, on both sides.
Right? If you get everything they want, somebody said in mediation, if you get everything you want, it was a failure. Some people truly, and it's the hardest thing, because mediation, at least on the community level that I do, divorce is something different when you have to, it's mandatory before you go into courts because they want to free up the courts. But in my case, it's voluntary. So what that means is everybody has to agree to it. And the biggest struggle to get people to mediation is there's always one person that doesn't want to do it. So sometimes you can mediate without that person, or you do some kind of conflict resolution without that person. But oftentimes when we do get that person, the risk again is going to court because they know what they've done is elder abuse. You can't take $500,000 out of your parents' account when they're power of attorney and buy a house with it. I'm not an attorney, but I kind of know that's illegal. So they'll begrudgingly come because there's nothing to lose. It's non-binding. Mm-hmm. And those are the people that interest enough benefit the most, because we may work it out that they agree. They don't have that $500,000 or they gambled it away. But when the estate settles after the parent passes, that can be credited and taken out of their share of the inheritance. It's not perfect. They're not getting the money right now, but parents don't prosecute their kids. I was on the fiduciary abuse team, I think, for 20 years, and I just didn't see it the most egregious thing. These are countywide. They just don't. So that's the kind of thing that can be settled.
You must see some really interesting cases. Tell us about some cases that you've had.
Okay, let me tell you, and I'll tell you the outcomes of them because I find it very interesting. So I got a call from a care manager. This was a few years back before the pandemic. And there was a 93-year-old woman had dementia, had been living with Florida with her spouse, a second husband, I think, and he died. And Adult Protective Services called the daughter who lived in Seattle to come and get the mom. That she was, it was self-neglect. So she took the mom up to Seattle, emergency, put her in a small boarding care. They took care of her. Wasn't a perfect placement. She wouldn't let the staff bathe her. The daughter had to come over, but it was an emergency system. So I get a call from the son. Everybody went to Yale and everybody were attorneys. So these were all like intellectuals. So the daughter wanted the mom to stay in Seattle and go. She found a very upscale, nice assisted memory care unit, high end, I know it, well-known branch that money was not an issue. In this case, the trust was already settled. So money wasn't an issue in any of this. But daughter wanted her to stay in Seattle. Son wanted her to come to LA. And he also, the most expensive assisted living here with a beautiful memory care. And he has a nice wife that would walk in on her and blah, blah, blah. He wanted her to be here. So here we have two children. They're both attorneys. Both of them are saying, I want her in Seattle and I want her in LA. So, and I'm going, and even the care manager went to Yale. I mean, it was like all these high IQ people. So, which is interesting. It doesn't make things easier necessarily. Mm-hmm. So I talked to them individually and I hear from the brother. He goes, my sister will never give up. All through her life, she has tantrums and I'd walk away, but I'm not going to do it this time. I really feel strongly. Daughter wants the mother up there. It turns out the mother wasn't such a nice mother. They both want to end it and have their mother there so they could, whatever issues they had with mom. Again, I know the issues. I don't want to be a therapist. I understood there's issues for both of them. So what ended up happening? And I was told that my sister never gives up. And he didn't say it when we met together. So what the outcome of this was, and it was really interesting because I really didn't know how this was going to end because it was right versus right. There were two good outcomes. We decided she would stay in Seattle for 3 months at the new place. It was brand new. So she would stay there. If she adjusted to the temperature, because that was an unknown coming to Seattle from Florida, and the staff and the daughter, if they could use their behavior, if they had a strong enough tube to help with bathing and that, she would remain there. We got an independent care manager to look at the markers we set up to decide if after 3 months, this didn't work, if she wasn't adjusting, she wasn't happy there, the staff couldn't take her, then she'd move to LA. That was the outcome. And I patted myself on the back and the care managers and we all did good. So I was at a conference and I saw I was done, whatever, 5-7 hours. And that was done. And I thought I was doing a great job and very impressed. And we wrote it all out. And it was all, they got to legalese both, make sure it was legal and all that stuff. They're all happy. So I asked the care manager what happened with this case. And she said, we never heard from the son again. So what he did is walked away like he did in every other case with the mother. So this is an example of one of the cases. Another that I did actually during COVID, it lasted a little longer only because the client needed my support. I got a call referred by an elder law attorney of a 102-year-old gentleman that wanted to amend his trust. And he had a daughter that he made his money. He had a lot of apartment buildings. He moved here at 20 from Poland, was a self-made man and was very successful. He had given most of his assets out during his lifetime, most of the apartment buildings to his children, his grandchildren, his great-grandchildren. He had one apartment building, a 48-unit building that was valued, was actually offered about $6 million. That's what he lived off the income for the caregivers and all this kind of stuff. He had left on his original trust that to his daughter entirely because he was estranged from his son. And the daughter hung in there, took care of all his bookkeeping, managed the apartment, was there 20 times a day. And he left this $6 million apartment to her. Well, the son came back in his life and he truly liked the son better than the daughter. I liked the son better than the daughter. Let the daughter keep the building, but he wanted to amend the trust. So the son got $1 million out of it. Mm-hmm. And the daughter went nuts. Mm. She went crazy. So he was being badgered. He didn't want them fighting after he amended this thing. He goes to change it. His longtime attorney, which was also his daughter's attorney, refused to change it because of his age. I knew he was totally competent. He's 100, so he's slower. He had a hard time writing and processing took a while. Didn't know the exact numbers, but he knew exactly what he had and the reasons. And so we ended up the outcome of this. So the daughter was crazy with this. We got a new attorney that thankfully was friends with the old attorney. So the daughter was comfortable with him too, somebody I knew, to amend this, to do the legal part. I spent a lot of time listening to the daughter and all her objections. She was afraid that she wouldn't be able to pay him back and she wouldn't have money and she'd have to sell the apartment. Went to all these objections that she'd get a financial planner to find out. There were all these objections. Son, I also talked to. He was a nice guy. God only knows what he did before with money and all this kind of stuff. I didn't want to know. Father adored him. He's a bright guy. Probably the father supported him his whole life. He wrote a best-selling book 30 years ago, and that was the last one. And he considered himself too intellectual. I think he had a PhD to run this business. So that's what stopped it. So what ended up happening? I had to bring in a psychiatrist over. This was all during COVID in my backyard with my 7-foot table with outside with a 102-year-old and a geriatric psychiatrist. And he indeed had capacity and he ended up changing it. And we worked out the details. So it wasn't a lump sum. And the father was comfortable with too, because he didn't want his son to waste the money, that he was paid over time. But the attorney added that the building was collateral. So she didn't pay him. He could get his money. So it worked out. She kept badgering him. And I actually, and she liked me. She liked me for a while until I told her I'm a mandated reporter. And this was psychological elder abuse. And she had to stop the badgering. And something came up later because her daughter was equally as strung out as she was, high strung and all this. And I made her be a mediator between her father and her daughter about changing carpets in a house that they were living in together. So anyways, it turned out he passed away just 6 months ago. I went to the funeral and it was really interesting. They're all speaking and there's no problems. And they didn't break their father's heart. It was awful. They were yelling. She was yelling, badgering him. So he got what he wanted. He took care of this son that he worried about, although didn't really have anything to worry about. That was taken care of. So those are the kind of things that there was a lot of money involved, but not really when it came down to it. And I did engage an attorney to do this, and he was very kind to him. And the advantage, I was actually on Zoom with the elderly gentleman, and the attorney didn't want to be in person, so he was on the other end. I could explain legally, slow it down a bit because of processing. That's where the knowledge of aging comes in. It didn't overwhelm him because there were questions in it. He was 102. So even though he didn't have dementia, this is a guy that was playing at bridge clubs before the pandemic struck.
Wow, and what a story.
So anyways, those are the kind of placement cases, home care cases. Another really interesting one was, this is one of these second wives, but it wasn't exactly a second wife. I got a call from a woman that had a partner of 25 years. They actually lived in the Palisades in her home, and they really had a love relationship. So he started becoming demented. She was made power of attorney for healthcare and finances for him. He had resources. He was an attorney, but didn't have a lot of extra resources. The woman had much more. He was living in her house, started having dementia. She was taking care of him. Kids were fine. There were 3 children and all was well. He started getting really demented and it was overwhelming for her and it was time for placement. Now the kids were going to have to start taking out of their estate. All of a sudden, the eldest son who lived up north wanted her to give up the power of attorney for him to make the decisions. The daughter wanted him placed closer to her because it was cheaper, the facilities, than being in Encino, which the girlfriend tried to get him halfway between the two. So she was, and they were calling again, badgering her to let them take over financial and personal decision-making now that he's not going to be living with her. And she wanted it. She felt she cared the most about her partner and she was respectful of them. So they came again during the pandemic to my house. The the older son was pissed that he was there. He goes, I don't want to be here. I just want power of attorney. The outcome of this is she was not going to give it up. And she was a smart lady, almost 80, but very smart. She kept the power of attorney, but she gave transparency with all the expenditures. We looked at what was of value to them. We looked at being able to budget in terms of the placement they did. We looked at being able, the one thing she had done is when there was an emergency, when they had one placement, she called her daughter instead of his daughter. And his daughter was very hurt that she didn't call her first. Now, she had young children and most of the time she wasn't available, but we wrote that into the agreement that he would call, if there's an emergency, she would, and she needed advice with placements. And the woman was a pretty good researcher. She'd ask her first. If she couldn't do it, she'd use her daughter for support. Remember, she was 80 years old and needed supports. So we wrote all this into the end. So nothing really happened legally, but certainly this family is now talking again and could meet. And they all love this guy. So they all were able to enjoy him. So those are the kind of outcomes I hope to have. They deal with legal things. They deal with financial things. And I know, but they're really family dynamics, a lot of this. And again, it's communication and looking at goals and focusing on goals. And if you look at the father's goals, he was demented, but friendly and wanted them all to get along. They've always gotten along. They didn't want to go to court over this. She would have won anyways. And the son, believe me, he would have taken her to court, but there was no grounds to get a power of attorney and take it away from her. She was taking great care of him. So these are end of life issues that parents put two children that don't get along on their power of attorney for healthcare, or they don't put anybody. One believes in, is religious and believes in keeping them alive no matter what. One of them wants to pull a plug or do palliative care or hospice care or all those kinds of things. I had one case that they were threatening if they took the mother off IV antibiotics because they'd have to take them out of a nursing home, that she would sue for wrongful death. This is despite a power of attorney. So you get these kinds of cases. Those are the kinds of cases that I get up. Again, home or placement is a big one and who they should live with and all these kinds of things. Some people are looking, for many, it's they're looking at their inheritance. And not necessarily in a bad way. This is what the parent wants. And to spend upwards of $200,000 a year on home care. Maybe the parent wanted it, maybe not. A private fiduciary would look at the best needs of the client, but we can look at the values and preferences of the client. Would they really, when they don't even know what they want, would they really want to stay home? Even though they said they want to stay home, can we balance that? They have a special needs child, and maybe they would much rather make sure that their child and their legacy is there. So third one that I've gotten multiple calls are, when there are children, when they're involved in children, and there tends to be more than one, generally three or four or five, there's always one, generally we like to think they're the youngest child, that had a lot of divorces, they had a lot of unemployment, maybe they had drug problems, and the parents have totally enabled them, and they've supported them their whole life. And then they become incapacitated and the kids go nuts. The other siblings that have resented them go nuts. So the question is this what the parent wanted? Would they continue supporting them and maybe having less money taking care of them or being inherited? Or would they cut them loose? Again, you've got this enabled child that may, or maybe a special needs child that really is not able at this to take care of themselves. So it's complicated. Yeah, you can go to court and figure this out, or you can figure out a way that respects the parents' wishes and looks at the reality of the situation and figures out some kind of solution to this that doesn't break the family apart.
Yeah, so. I think that's exactly what it is. I mean, you are trying to take everyone's goal and somehow bring them together in a cohesive whole and really honoring the whoever the parent is or the senior that comes to you with their agenda and make some sense of it. And it sounds like you're sort of boiling down to really the issues.
And then we have a plan. So it
come up with a plan, right?
then it can go back to the placement people if it's placement. It can go back to you if you do. It can go back to the attorneys to get an amendment on trust document. It's just when they're stuck, it can go back to the family that's caregiving. And now they have a plan so they can move forward and not be stalled where everybody loses. It really is a great tool for those. The biggest obstacles, as I said, that it is voluntary.
Mm-hmm. So everyone has to agree to come in. Everyone has to agree to talk to each other. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And so if I wanted to find someone like you, is there an association? Is there somewhere? You
know, the mediators and even the elder mediation are usually through the Bar Association. So so there are mediators and the mediation process works the exact same as I do it. It's just, there's some differences. I tend to people find them through the communities, through the aging life care community, because they know people, because we're multidisciplinary. So they know all kinds of people, or elder law attorneys tend to know them, or other professional associations that are kind of holistic. I'd say maybe PFAC, some of the conservators may know about them, although they tend to be a little more financial based and a little less, more court oriented. There are a few people that train elder mediators and they use this community-based approach. They would know people in the community. There's one in Boston, one in Seattle. There are very few of them, but they do exist. Strauss Institute has an elder, which is, I took it thinking, well, I probably know this stuff, but maybe there's things I don't know. And there's legal things. It's more legal oriented, but they probably have resources up there. I think Googling is probably, that's a crazy thing. And then supporting and getting references afterwards. So,
right. So usually through an attorney.
Perfect answers. I can tell you how to get a care manager. I can tell you how to get a marriage family therapist or an elder attorney. Right.
More word of mouth through your attorney, yeah, or referral through your attorney.
Decided what the skill set was and what I like to do and how I could use my knowledge and background to do something that's satisfying for me and in the stage of my life, more short-term in nature. And I do take on some of these cases more for coaching than therapy, that if it's really caregiving directed and these people call because they're fighting with their families and things, and the family is just not interested, I can coach them. So I do some of that more long-term and sporadic. I have 3 70-year-old trust recipients that lack decision-making abilities. So I'm there as supports for them. And they're not all the time, but one's moving from out of the country, one's in San Francisco and got a surprise amount of money and I'm helping them spend it. And one is really on the spectrum and scared of his sister who manages his trust. So, those are kind of different things there.
Bunny, thank you for coming on today and talking about your history and your life now as an elder mediator. It's fascinating work and it's challenging. It sounds like the cases are complicated. They're contentious to start with. And then you work through issues, come up with a plan, and people, as you say, move forward, which is really, it's brilliant work. So thank you for that.
Thanks for having me and best of luck. Keep on doing what you're doing.
Thanks.
Thank you for joining us today on another episode of Dementia Discussions. If you're a caregiver or know someone who's a caregiver that would like to be a guest on the show, please call me at 310-362-8232 or go to dementiadiscussions.net/contact and let me know. I would love to have you. Remember that you can follow Dementia Discussions on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and many more. If you listen on Apple Podcasts, it would mean a lot if you would leave me a review. For any other information about this podcast, please visit me at dementiadiscussions.net. And please share this podcast with someone you know if you think it may help. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you here again next time on Dementia Discussions.